Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The decision by the U.S. Supreme Court last month that upheld the Affordable Care Act has also opened up a new avenue of opposition by states that have filed suit against the health care reform law. In its decision, the court said in essence that states could opt out of the law's expansion of Medicaid with no penalties to its existing programs. Under the ACA, the federal government will help states expand their coverage of Medicaid patients to 133% of the poverty line. Already, several states, Texas, Florida, Louisiana, Mississippi, and South Carolina, have stated they will reject the expansion. Many other states are leaning towards that position as well. This despite the federal government's infusion of nearly all of the cost of the expansion. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities Analysis, the federal government will assume 93% of the expansion costs over the first 8 years of the law. That's over $6 billion coming into the Oklahoma economy during that period. In fact, in Oklahoma, that expansion of Medicaid would lower the non-insured rate among the eligible by over 50%. So there are two questions the state must make in this next year regarding the Affordable Care Act. First, whether to assume the expansion of Medicaid. The second will be revisiting the health insurance exchange issue. The state rejected a health insurance exchange while the litigation was in process in the U.S. Supreme Court. But if the state does not set up its own exchange, the federal government will come in and set up one of its own. To talk about these issues is Dr. Jeff Alderman, an OU Tulsa physician specializing in palliative care and also in health care policy at the university, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Alderman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
The state has two big decisions, one which they've sort of already made, but I think they're going to have to revisit in this upcoming legislative session, and a decision for the governor, really. It is involving whether to expand Medicaid to accommodate the Affordable Care Act. And the second one would be revisiting the issue of setting up health care and health insurance exchanges. What are some of the issues the governor should be thinking about when she's thinking about these issues?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the show. Just to talk a little bit broadly about the Affordable Care Act. First of all, the Affordable Care Act, which was passed by Congress and signed into law in 2010, but just recently upheld by the Supreme Court, really has three aims. The first aim is to improve healthcare access. And that's really the big point that most people are talking about. The second aim is to improve quality and outcomes for healthcare for the American population. And the third is to try to get a handle on lowering costs to deliver care more efficiently. Part of the Affordable Care Act is an expansion of Medicaid, which is health insurance for the poor. And to deliver Medicaid insurance right now in Oklahoma, like many states, it's kind of limited. Just being poor alone is not enough. You actually have to be poor and disabled or poor and elderly. There's all kinds of caveats. And what the Affordable Care Act is doing is it's expanding Medicaid if states want to take it. And some states, like Texas, Governor Rick Perry said, absolutely not. We will not have an expanded Medicaid program from the federal government. I think Florida did the same. Bobby Jindal in Louisiana said something similar. I think what the governor here in Oklahoma is deciding is whether or not to accept this this Medicaid expansion from the federal government. And I think, actually, Mary Fallon has done a nice job in trying to weigh the pros and the cons and not come out with a concrete answer just yet.
Now, one of the big things about this is that the federal government provides most of the money for the new additions. Now, how you qualify the new additions is a real interesting thing, because what the Affordable Care Act does is expands the eligibility for Medicaid from the poverty line up to 133% of the poverty line. Now, the caveat is that those that should have qualified under the existing Medicaid who weren't enrolled, that's the state's responsibility. Isn't that the case?
That's correct.
Now, how, as a state, how is Oklahoma at enrolling those who are eligible? You mentioned all the sort of tightening of the guidelines here in the state. Is that going to be a problem for the state?
Well, it really depends on whether or not the state decides to go ahead and accept the expansion. If they do accept the expansion, you'll see that anybody who has 133% above the poverty line or lower in terms of annual income will be eligible for Medicaid. Right now, there are not great efforts to try to enroll folks into the program, although local providers, hospitals, doctors do try to steer their patients who have no insurance and are eligible for current Medicaid to go ahead and enroll. If the expansion is accepted in Oklahoma, basically anybody who is at 133% or above the poverty line in terms of annual income will have access to enroll. The problem is, after 3 years, the federal government is going to stop paying for 100% of those expanded costs. So the state of Oklahoma will be on the hook for 10% of funding Medicaid after 2014 or 2015.
Now, as I understand it, that is a rolling rate. It could be anywhere between 90 and 95%. Will Oklahoma be a 90% state?
As far as we understand right now, the federal government is still going to pick up the lion's share of the Medicaid expansion. But who knows what's going to happen to the federal budget 3 years from now, 5 years from now. It's difficult to tell.
Mm-hmm. So this is one of the issues the governor will have to weigh. But really, if you look at it from just a cash basis, it's a major influx of federal money into the state. It's like $6 billion, which is the annual state budget now over 10 years. Where the state, it looks like it's maybe the total commitment over 10 years is around $500 million, like $500 million.
That's correct. And Wayne Green from the Tulsa World wrote a very nice piece on Sunday, kind of comparing and contrasting the pros and the cons of Medicaid expansion for our state. And just to speak a little bit to that, if Oklahoma does go ahead and accept the Medicaid expansion, all those additional federal dollars, we should see the number of uninsured people in Oklahoma drop by about half. Right now, about 624,000 people in Oklahoma have no health insurance. That number should drop to under 300,000 people.
Yeah, in fact, Oklahoma ranks ninth as far as the states to benefit most from Medicaid expansion. I think the number of uninsured is expected to decrease by 53%.
That's absolutely correct. That's the number that's being batted around. The other thing we know about people who have insurance, even those on Medicaid, they are healthier people. That if there is insurance that allows one to go see a physician, blood pressure can be checked, cancer can be screened for, cholesterol can be checked, diabetes can be screened for, babies are born at more appropriate birth weights. Insurance is a good thing to maintaining a healthy population. I think the argument really has been not so much should we promote health as a society. I think everyone pretty much agrees that we should. The question is what is the government's role in providing that health? And Jabbar Shumate, a representative in the Oklahoma House from Tulsa, basically believes that it is our prerogative as a state to help provide insurance for those that can't otherwise access it.
Well, we've already had state health exchanges earlier, which was about, you know, trying to pull folks into groups so that they could purchase, like, SoonerCare and things like that. This would be a step beyond SoonerCare?
Well, it's more complicated than that. Basically, what the Affordable Care Act is trying to do is make sure that everyone in America has access to health insurance. Just to basically summarize, if you are employed in a business that provides health insurance, you'll continue to receive your benefits with very little change. If you are poor and you're on Medicaid, that won't change. But if you're poor and you don't qualify for Medicaid, if Oklahoma accepts the expansion, then there will be some increased dollars, just as we talked about, to help people afford Medicaid. And then for those that are caught in the middle, they don't qualify for Medicaid, but can't get insurance through their employer, that's where the exchanges start to open up.
Yeah, and that is the second decision the governor will have to either revisit, or I'm sure it will come up in the next legislative session, because if the state does not set up a state health insurance exchange, the federal government, as part of the act, will come in and set up a health insurance exchange.
That's correct. Each state will have their own exchange, and it's widely believed that most states, believing that states can take care of their citizens using their own interventions, their own nuances, can design the best exchange for their people. I really see little in the way of Oklahoma accepting a federally mandated exchange.
Yeah, give us a sense of what that exchange would look like. Say you're above the expanded Medicaid, or if the state decides not to accept it, then, you know, current Medicaid guidelines. Your business is too small. This is one of the other things. There's been a lot of misperception that all businesses are going to have to offer insurance to their employees. If you're under 50 employees, you're off the hook entirely. So people will be going to these medical insurance exchanges. How are they going to work? How will it be like what I've seen of how Medicare works, where you're signing up for various insurances, you're inundated with offers and you pick one?
Sort of. I think the idea is that you will go online and you will have a group of different plans to choose from. And some of the plans may be more expensive and offer more benefits, or some may be a little less expensive and have less in terms of benefit.
But high deductibles, maybe.
Correct. Mm-hmm. But the idea being that you will be able to purchase an insurance plan that works for you, and the fact that they're all available on the exchange will foster a sense of competition, which will drive costs down. And another piece that's very important about the Affordable Care Act is that, let's say you work in a business that doesn't provide health insurance. You earn, let's say you're a family of four, you earn about $80,000 a year. That puts you at about 350 to 375% above the federal poverty level. It turns out that with the Affordable Care Act, there will be subsidies available for anyone who's 400% or below the federal poverty level to buy insurance on the exchange. So there actually will be assistance for people who are of lower income, all the way up to 400% of the federal poverty level, to help finance the purchasing of health insurance. The idea is that no one should be without health insurance.
Of course, this year is the first year under the Affordable Care Act for people, individuals buying insurance. Really, I guess it applies to employer group insurance as well. If the insurer did not spend, 80% of their premiums on benefits, refund checks come from the insurance company. This is another way to try to control costs?
Yeah, that's correct. When the legislation was being crafted, the health insurance companies actually did get on board and agree to certain provisions that may cut some of their revenues. But what the insurance companies did agree to is the fact that they supported the individual mandate. Everybody should be in the pool to purchase health insurance. And the reason is it prevents what's called adverse selection. Adverse selection being the fact that if people come and go in and out of insurance plans, we'll only be covering the people who are at highest risk, highest cost, and then those who are young and healthy and have no health issues won't be paying into the system, and therefore the insurance companies will eventually do poorly.
I think that gets back to the original argument for increasing access to health care, is that people without insurance still use the health care system. They pay what they can, but they're using health care often the most expensively. That means emergency room, urgent care. And you're not really treating the symptoms, not the underlying causes, oftentimes, because of the way healthcare is delivered.
That's correct. And my concern is that the Affordable Care Act goes pretty far to increase access, that more and more people will have access to health insurance. I'm not sure it does enough to focus on prevention, and that's really where the major issues are. That if you can get folks to visit, rather than the emergency room, their primary care provider, you can do a lot more work to prevent some of those big ticket items from occurring down the road, like a heart attack, a stroke, a cancer that could have been prevented. Right now, for example, if you go and visit your primary care provider, Medicaid will pay about $30, $40 for that visit. But if you don't have insurance, if you do have Medicaid insurance, but you don't visit a primary care provider and you go to the emergency department, Medicaid will pay $300, $400, $500 for that same visit, which makes no sense. So improving access, trying to get more people seen within the primary care space, is going to help improve disease and foster prevention.
Well, now that is an argument the opponents make, is that, you know, the way Medicaid structures its payments, it's not good for the primary care physician. It rewards, you know, the most intervention and expensive health care. Are there any fixes in this Affordable Care Act that sort of address the fact that, you know, if I'm a Medicaid patient and I go to the emergency room, the doctor there makes $300-$400 as opposed to the primary care physician on a regular basis who's making $30.
That's a great question. And we know that patients who are seen in emergency rooms are not necessarily getting the best care. Yes, they're having their acute issue addressed, but the care is often fragmented. It's not coordinated. It doesn't lead necessarily to healthier people. We know that the best care is delivered when a team of providers, a physician and others, nurses, social workers are all involved together to provide care in what's called the patient-centered medical home. This seems to lead to the healthiest people who can be managed over time.
My guest today is Dr. Jeff Alderman, OU Tulsa physician. He specializes in healthcare policy and palliative care. We're talking about two decisions the state must make regarding the Affordable Care Act, the expansion of Medicaid, which is coming right up, and then setting up health insurance exchanges, which were, if by 2014 those aren't set up, the federal government will come in and set up their own insurance exchanges. Now, let's talk about some of the con arguments, which one is, you know, right now we have a shortage of primary care physicians. You're going to add a lot more people into the ranks of the insured who, if this works out right, will be utilizing primary care instead of other forms of care. How are we going to be able to handle this?
Yeah, that's a great question, Rich. Right now, Oklahoma has one of the lowest per capita ratios of physicians to the population. And you're absolutely right that as we go forward with more people carrying health insurance of some sort, we're going to need more providers. The big question is do we need more doctors? And that is really up in the air. I think what is more clear is that we're going to need more people to deliver health care. And I'll cite the example of Dr. Jeff Brenner, who is a family practice doctor in Camden, New Jersey. And he was featured in an article in The New Yorker several years ago who looked at the delivery of care in the poorest city in America, Camden, New Jersey. And what he figured out is that disease occurs all throughout the city, but especially in pockets, what he called hotspots, where the population is particularly unhealthy in one apartment building or one city block. And what his recommendation is to bring a healthcare provider to that population, putting a nurse in that apartment building, putting a nurse practitioner in that nursing home where the sickest, most expensive patients reside. And what he has shown is that by delivering care to people at their home, at a site that's much easier to access than, say, a primary care office, that disease can be mitigated. And what he's found is that emergency visits go down, admissions and readmissions to the hospital go down, and people are actually healthier when you employ more mid-level healthcare providers, including nurses.
Now, I can certainly see that in a highly urbanized setting where, and it's very densely populated now. You know, a place like Tulsa, you go even to a smaller town in Oklahoma, we're all spread out. Are we likely to see hot spots like that?
Absolutely. And if you look at the city of Tulsa, we are an incredibly disparate population. We know that people who live in South Tulsa, I think it was zip code 74136, actually live an average of 14 years longer than people that live in North Tulsa. I think it was zip code 74104. And that has a lot to do with access to health care and insurance. So one of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act is the creation of something called the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. And this is a program designed to study new techniques of healthcare delivery, kind of what Dr. Brenner did in Camden. And there are actually a couple of pilot projects going on right now in Tulsa. There's one that's focusing on a vulnerable population called the dual eligibles. And these are often poor people, low-income people who have complex medical illnesses or behavioral illnesses like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. These patients represent about 17 to 18% of the Medicare population, but about 40% of all of the costs. And by using the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovations pilot project and funding, right now in Tulsa, we're looking at ways to intervene to take care of these dual eligible patients in a more meaningful way. And a lot of that is through the notion of hotspotting, of finding out where the sickest patients live, and can we bring in what are called care navigators or care managers to those people to help them with everything from acquiring pharmaceuticals, transportation to the doctor's office, arranging better ways to eat, to exercise, et cetera, et cetera.
Let me ask you about another issue that opponents will bring up is the inflexibility of the federal government and how it reimburses currently under Medicare and Medicaid. You know, it's common to come into a doctor's office you've never been to before, and there'll be a little sign, we're not accepting Medicaid patients, or not, sometimes Medicare patients as well. Can you talk about that sort of inflexibility? And if you expand that, is that going to make doctors' lives more difficult? Will the cost of complying with federal regulations sort of eat up the cost savings that this act envisions?
That's a really good question, Rich. And there's one laboratory we can look at that's going on right now in the United States, and that's the state of Massachusetts. About 4 years ago, no more than that now, maybe 5-6 years ago, they began to implement basically mandated insurance.
I think anybody who's following the news is aware of this.
Yeah. So it's a big deal, and it was introduced by then Governor Mitt Romney. And what we know in Massachusetts is that they are the most insured population in the country. I think 98% of all citizens of Massachusetts carry health insurance. What we also know is that access to care can be more difficult because there are just so many primary care providers. In the city of Boston, which arguably has the highest ratio of physicians per capita to the population, it's still very difficult to find and secure an appointment with a primary care provider. Much harder in the western part of Massachusetts, which is much more sparsely populated.
So, but what about the whole federal regulation issue?
Well, what the Affordable Care Act is trying to do is upgauge the rates of reimbursement to providers for those who are enrolled in Medicare and Medicaid. So what the Affordable Care Act will do is provide increased reimbursement to primary care physicians who are seeing patients who carry Medicare insurance. Right now, if a patient has private commercial insurance, let's say through Blue Cross, you might make X dollars on each patient visit. If you have Medicare insurance, that primary care provider gets about X minus $30. And I think what the government is doing is trying to ratchet up the rates for patients who have Medicare insurance, and similarly with Medicaid insurance, so that primary care providers will be much more incentivized to see these patients. But again, we don't know what exactly that's going to look like.
Now, hasn't that been a budgetary yo-yo with the federal government sort of messing around with the reimbursement rates as the cost of the program increases or doesn't increase as much as expected?
That's a huge issue, and there's a great deal of double counting that's taking place. If you look at the estimates that the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, has made in terms of what will the Affordable Care Act do to our budget, they are estimating right now that in a 10-year period between 2012 and 2021, $210 billion will be reduced from the deficit, which sounds like a lot of money, but considering the fact that we spend about $1 trillion a year on health care, $21 billion a year is just a drop in the bucket. Now, that being said, there's a gentleman named Douglas Holtz Aiken, who was the director of CBO under President George W. Bush and then advised the McCain campaign in 2008. His feelings are that the Affordable Care Act will actually increase the deficit by $562 billion. So one of the cons of the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion is we really don't know what's going to happen to spending. If improving access to care and quality of care and mandating all citizens to carry insurance is going to improve our deficit position, or will it worsen it? And it tends to be drawn along political lines.
And I think it really comes down to the idea if people who have been uninsured are insured, will they use the medical system more than they did before? And if they are using it more, are they using it in an efficient way than they were before that will save enough money from, say, going to your primary care physician like once every 2 to 3 months as opposed to the emergency room when things get so bad in a chronic illness that you can't do anything about it? So, I mean, it sounds like it is very much up in the air.
Looking at the Massachusetts example, we know that folks who carry health insurance are going to visit the doctor more often. There's no question about that. Are they healthier as a result of it? Are they more productive? Are they having fewer absent days from work or from school? Are they having lower risks of heart attacks and strokes and cancer? We just don't know.
I would really think that health policy professionals would be studying this intensely. Are those studies going on?
Oh, they're ongoing. And the only preliminary data I've seen is that in Massachusetts, the rate of emergency department visits is actually lower during business hours Monday through Friday. So about 8% fewer visits to Massachusetts emergency rooms because more patients are seeing more providers in an office setting rather than in...
But 8%, that's pretty low.
8% may be low, but when you're talking about billions of dollars,
it does add up, yeah. My guest today is Dr. Jeff Alderman, of an OU Tulsa physician specializing in palliative care and also healthcare policy. We're talking about two decisions a state must make regarding the Affordable Care Act, the expansion of Medicaid, which Governor Fallon hasn't come out either side on, and setting up health insurance exchanges, which I think the governor originally was thinking about doing it. The legislature balked and they laid off that and said no for now, wanted to see how the Supreme Court decision came out. Well, it has come out now, and the Affordable Care Act is constitutional. So I'm sure they'll be revisiting that in this coming year. Say the state doesn't expand Medicaid, doesn't set up health insurance exchanges. Obviously, the federal government will set up health insurance exchanges. But as far as the number of uninsured in the state, will that make really much of a dent?
We really don't know. And I think part of the problem of the response to the Affordable Care Act is that there's a lot of political messaging that it's all good or it's all bad. The Affordable Care Act is a little bit like tax code. It's so complicated that it's really hard to know what the actual ramifications are. We don't know if it's going to necessarily improve health care, but we haven't heard a robust response from people who oppose the Affordable Care Act in what would take its place.
I was going to say, I was reading in one of the Con articles not too long ago, and I actually heard a doctor saying, I would rather have a patient without insurance come to my door and I'll have him pay whatever he can rather than have it come through Medicaid or some sort of federal reimbursement scheme. And I was really kind of flabbergasted about it because this is what doctors have been railing about for 30, 40 years.
Yeah, many physicians are fatigued by the amount of regulation and paperwork that comes across their desks. And the idea of having a patient pay a certain value up front without going through the rigor of filing a claim with the government, processing that claim, I can see where many people are fatigued from all of that. So I think, again, part of the effort of the Affordable Care Act in trying to improve healthcare delivery is to streamline that process so the administrative burden and cost is actually lowered. And I think these are initiatives we'll see emerge over the next several years.
So in conclusion, what is your thought about where this is? Is this, I haven't heard too many proponents say this is it. This is maybe a first step or are the things that really need to be fixed about the law, in your opinion?
I think in general, the Affordable Care Act is probably a good thing. I think healthier people in our country is going to lead to greater happiness, greater productivity. It's going to allow our nation to grow. That being said, I worry that the Affordable Care Act really is a Band-Aid and not a comprehensive solution. But I think that over time, if there is a commitment to not just improving access, but improving quality and finding a way to improve the delivery of Medicare and Medicaid to make it more efficient, it really can lower costs. I do think the administration did not market the Affordable Care Act very, very well. I think most people are confused by what it offers and as a result have concluded their opinions about the Affordable Care Act based on political messaging they receive, as opposed to studying the act.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens in this coming upcoming legislative session. Dr. Alderman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
OU Tulsa physician Dr. Jeff Alderman speaking with us about two decisions the state must make regarding the Affordable Care Act. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, you can listen to it anytime online at publicradiotulsa.org or just simply catch up with the latest news at our website. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.